size with a fearful hiss, only to sink at once as if on the point of going out. I thrust the one I had uprooted at Baldanders, shouting, "No! No! Back! Back!" prompted again by Dr. Talos. Baldanders responded by roaring more furiously than ever. He strained at the chain in a way that made the scenery wall to which he was bound creak and snap, and his mouth began, quite literally, to foam, a thick white liquid running from the corners of his lips to bedew his huge chin and fleck his rusty black clothes as though with snow. Someone in the audience screamed, and the chain broke, with a report like the snapping of a drover's whip. By this time, the giant's face was hideous in its madness, and I would no more have attempted to stand in his way than to stop an avalanche. But before I could move a step to escape him, he had wrested the torch from me and knocked me down with its iron shaft. I got my head up in time to see him jerk the other torch from its place and make for the audience with both. The shrieking of men drowned the shrilling of women. It sounded as if our guild were exercising 100 clients together. I pulled myself up and was about to seize Dorcas and dash for the cover of the copse when I saw Dr. Talos. He seemed filled with what I can only call malignant good humor. And though he was freeing himself from his fastenings, he was taking his time about it. Jolenta was setting herself free as well, and if there were any expression at all on that perfect face, it was one of relief.
"Very well," Dr. Talos exclaimed.
"Very well indeed. You may come back now, Baldanders. Don't leave us in the dark." To me, "Did you enjoy your maiden experience of the boards, Master Torturer? For a beginner acting without rehearsal, you played nicely enough." I managed to nod. "Except when Baldanders knocked you down. You must forgive him. He could see you didn't know enough to drop. Come with me now. Baldanders has his talents, but a fine eye for minutiae lost in grass isn't one of them. I have some lights backstage, and you in innocence shall help us pick up." I did not understand what he meant, but in a few moments the torches were back in place, and we were hunting through the trampled area in front of the stage with dark lanterns. "It's a gambling proposition," Dr. Talos explained, "and I confess to loving them. The money in the hat is a sure thing. By the close of the first act, I can predict to an aura chalk how much it will be. But the dropsies, they may be no more than 2 apples and a turnip, or as much as the imagination can encompass. We have found a baby pig. Delicious. So Baldanders told me when he ate it. We have found a baby. We have found a gold-headed stick, and I retain it. Antique brooches, shoes. We frequently find shoes of all kinds. Just now I have found a woman's parasol." He held it up. "This will be just the thing to keep the sun from our fair Jolenta when we go strolling tomorrow." Jolenta straightened up as people do who are straining not to stoop. Above the waist, her creamy amplitude was such that her spine must have been curved backward to balance the weight.
"If we're going to an inn tonight, I'd like to go now," she said. "I'm very tired, Doctor."
I was exhausted myself. "An inn? Tonight? A criminal waste of funds. Look at it this way, my dear. The nearest is a legal way at the very least, and it would take Baldanders and me a watch to pack the scenery and properties, even with the help of this friendly angel of torment. By the time we reach the inn at that rate, the horizon would be under the sun, the cocks would be crowing, and, like as not, 1,000 fools would be rising, banging their doors and throwing their slops." Baldanders grunted. I thought in confirmation, then struck with his boot as if at some venomous thing he had discovered in the grass. Dr. Talos threw wide his arms to embrace the universe.
While here, my dear, beneath stars that are the personal and cherished property of the Increate, we have all anyone could wish for the most salubrious rest.
There's just chill enough in the air tonight to make sleepers grateful for the warmth of their coverings and the heat of the fire, and not a hint of rain.
Here we will camp. Here we will break our fast in the morning, and from here we will walk renewed in the joyful hours when the day is young.
I said, "You mentioned something about breakfast. Is there any food now? Dorcas and I are hungry."
"Of course there is. I see Baldanders has just picked up a basket of yams."
Several members of our erstwhile audience must have been farm people, returning from a market, with whatever produce they had been unable to sell. Besides the yams, we had, eventually, a pair of squabs and several stalks of young sugarcane. There was not much bedding, but there was some, and Dr. Talos himself used none of it, saying he would sit up and watch the fire, and perhaps nap later, in the chair that had been the Autarch's throne and the Inquisitor's bench a short time before.
Chapter 33 Five Legs. For perhaps a watch I lay awake. I soon realized that Dr. Talos was not going to sleep, but I clung to the hope that he would leave us for one reason or another. He sat for a time as if deep in thought, then stood and began to pace up and down before the fire. His was an immobile yet expressive face. A slight movement of one eyebrow or the cocking of his head could change it utterly. And as he passed back and forth before my half-closed eyes, I saw sorrow, glee, desire, ennui, resolution, and a score of other emotions that have no names flicker across that vulpine mask. At last he began to swing his cane at the blossoms of wild flowers. In a short time, he had decapitated all those within a dozen steps of the fire. I waited until I could no longer see his erect, energetic figure, and only faintly hear the whistling strokes of his cane. Then slowly, I drew forth the gem. It was as if I held a star, a thing that burned in the light. Dorcas was asleep, and though I had hoped that we could examine the gem together, I forbore from waking her. The icy blue radiance waxed, until I was afraid Dr. Talos would see it, far off as he was. I held the gem to my eye with some childish idea of viewing the fire through it as through a lens, then snatched it away. The familiar world of grass and sleepers had become no more than a dance of sparks, slashed by a scimitar blade. I am not sure how old I was when Master Malrubius died. It was a number of years before I became captain, so I must have been quite a small boy. I remember very well, however, how it was when Master Palaemon succeeded him as Master of Apprentices. Master Malrubius had held that position ever since I had been aware that such a thing existed, and for weeks and perhaps months it seemed to me that Master Palaemon, though I liked him as well or better, could not be our real master in the sense that Master Malrubius had been. The atmosphere of dislocation and unreality was heightened by the knowledge that Master Malrubius was not dead, or even away. That he was in fact merely lying in his cabin, lying in the same bed he had slept in each night when he was still teaching and disciplining us. There is a saying that unseen is as good as unbeen. But in this case it was otherwise.
unseen, Master Malrubius was more palpably present than ever before. Master Palaemon refused to assert that he would never return, and so every act was weighed in double scales. Would Master Palaemon permit it? And what would Master Malrubius say? In the end, he said nothing. Torturers do not go to the Tower of Healing, no matter how ill. There is a belief, whether true or not I cannot say, that old scores are settled there. If I were writing this history to entertain, or even to instruct, I would not digress here to discuss Master Malrubius, who must, at the moment when I thrust away the claw, have been dust for long years. But in a history, as in other things, there are necessities and necessities. I know little of literary style, but I have learned as I have progressed, and find this art not so much different from my old one as might be thought. Many scores and sometimes many hundreds of persons come to watch an execution, and I have seen balconies torn from their walls by the weight of the watchers, killing more in their single crash than I in my career. These scores and hundreds may be likened to the readers of a written account. But there are others besides these spectators who must be satisfied. The authority in whose name the Carnifex acts. Those who have given him money so that the condemned may have an easy or a hard death. And the Carnifex himself. The spectators will be content if there are no long delays, if the condemned is permitted to speak briefly and does it well, if the upraised blade gleams in the sun for a moment before it descends, thus giving them time to catch breath and nudge one another, and if the head falls with a satisfactory gout of blood. Similarly, you, who will someday delve in Master Ultan's library, will require of me no long delays. Personages who are permitted to speak only briefly yet do it well, certain dramatic pauses which shall signal to you that something of import is about to occur, excitement, and a sating quantity of blood. The authorities for whom the Carnifex acts, the Kiliarchs and Archons, if I may be permitted to prolong my figure of speech, will have little complaint if the condemned is prevented from escaping, or much inflaming the mob, and if he is undeniably dead at the conclusion of the proceedings. That authority, as it seems to me, in my writing, is the impulse that drives me to my task. Its requirements are that the subject of this work must remain central to it, not escaping into prefaces or indexes or into another work entirely, that the rhetoric not be permitted to overwhelm it, and that it be carried to a satisfactory conclusion. Those who have paid the Carnifex to make the act a painless or a painful one may be likened to the literary traditions and accepted models to which I am compelled to bow. I recall that one winter day, when cold rain beat against the window of the room where he gave us our lessons, Master Malrubius, perhaps because he saw we were too dispirited for serious work, perhaps only because he was dispirited himself, told us of a certain Master Werenfrid of our guild who, in olden times, being in grave need, accepted remuneration from the enemies of the condemned and from his friends as well, and who, by stationing one party on the right of the block and the other on the left, by his great skill, made it appear to each that the result was entirely satisfactory. In just this way, the contending parties of tradition pull at the writers of histories. Yes, even at autarchs. One desires ease, the other richness of experience in the execution of the writing. And I must try, in the dilemma of Master Werenfred, but lacking his abilities, to satisfy each. This I have attempted to do. There remains the Carnifex himself. I am he.
It is not enough for him to earn praise from all. It is not enough even for him to perform his function in a way he knows to be entirely creditable and in keeping with the teaching of his masters and the ancient traditions. In addition to all this, if he is to feel full satisfaction at the moment when time lifts his own severed head by the hair, he must add to the execution some feature, however small, that is entirely his own and that he will never repeat. Only thus can he feel himself a free artist. When I shared a bed with Bald Anders, I dreamed a strange dream. And in composing this history, I did not hesitate to relate it. The relation of dreams being entirely in the literary tradition. At the time I write of now, when Dorcas and I slept under the stars with Bald Anders and Jolenta, and Dr. Talos sat by, I experienced what may have been less or greater than a dream, and that is outside that tradition. I give warning to you, who will later read this, that it has little bearing on what will soon follow. I give it only because it puzzled me at the time, and it will provide me with satisfaction to relate it. Yet it may be that insofar as it entered my mind and has remained there from that time to this, it affected my actions during the latter part of my narrative. With the claw safely hidden away, I lay stretched on an old blanket near the fire. Dorcas lay with her head near mine, Jolenta with her feet to mine, Bald Anders on his back on the opposite side of the fire, his thick-soled boots among the embers. Dr. Talos's chair stood near the giant's hand, but it was turned away from the fire. Whether or not he did sit in it with his face to the night, I cannot say. For parts of the time I'm going to relate, I seemed conscious of his presence in the chair. At other times I sensed that he was absent. The sky was growing lighter, I believe, than it is at full dark. Footfalls reached my ears, yet hardly disturbed my rest, heavy yet softly pattering. Then the sound of breath, the snuffling of an animal. If I was awake, my eyes were open. But I was still so nearly in sleep that I did not turn my head. The animal approached me and sniffed at my clothes and my face. It was Driscoll. And Driscoll lay down with his spine pressed against my body. It did not seem odd then that he had found me, though I recall feeling a certain pleasure at seeing him again. Once more I heard footsteps, now the slow, firm tread of a man. I knew at once that it was Master Malruvius. I could recall his step in the corridors under the tower, on the days when we made the rounds of the cells, the sound was the same. He came into the circle of my vision. His cloak was dusty, as it always was, save on the most formal occasions. He drew it about him in the old way as he seated himself in a box of properties.
Severian, name for me the seven principles of governance.
It was an effort for me to speak. But I managed in my dream, if it was a dream, to say, I do not recall that we have studied such a thing, Master.
You are always the most careless of my boys, he told me and fell silent.
A foreboding grew on me. I sensed that if I did not reply, some tragedy would occur. At last I began, weakly. Anarchy.
That is not governance, but the lack of it. I taught you that it precedes all governance. Now list the seven sorts.
Attachment to the person of the monarch. Attachment to a bloodline or other sequence of succession. Attachment to the royal state. Attachment to a code legitimizing the governing state. Attachment to the law only. Attachment to a greater or lesser board of electors as framers of the law. Attachment to an abstraction.
conceived as including the body of electors, other bodies giving rise to them, and numerous other elements, largely ideal, tolerable. Of these, which is the earliest form and which the highest? The development is in the order given, Master, I said. But I do not recall that you ever asked before which was highest. Master Malrubius leaned forward, his eyes burning brighter than the coals of the fire.
Which is highest, Severian?
The last, Master.
You mean attachment to an abstraction conceived as including the body of electors, other bodies giving rise to them, and numerous other elements largely ideal?
Yes, Master.
Of what kind, Severian, is your own attachment to the divine entity?
I said nothing. It may have been that I was thinking, but if so, my mind was too much filled with sleep to be conscious of its thought. Instead, I became profoundly aware of my physical surroundings. The sky above my face, in all its grandeur, seemed to have been made solely for my benefit and to be presented for my inspection now. I lay upon the ground as upon a woman, and the very air that surrounded me seemed a thing as admirable as crystal and as fluid as wine. Answer me, Severian. The first, if I have any.
To the person of the monarch?
Yes, because there is no succession.
The animal that rests beside you now would die for you. Of what kind is his attachment to you?
The first?
There was no one there.
I sat up.
Malrubius and Triskel had vanished. Yet my side felt faintly warm.
Chapter 34 Morning.
You are awake,
Dr. Talos said.
I trust you slept well.
I had a strange dream. I stood and looked about.
There's no one here but ourselves.
As though he were reassuring a child, Dr. Talos gestured toward Baldanders and the sleeping women. I dreamed my dog, he has been lost for years now, came back and lay beside me. I could still feel the warmth of his body when I woke.
You were lying beside a fire,
Dr. Talos pointed out.
There has been no dog here.
A man, dressed much as I am.
Dr. Talos shook his head. I could not have failed to see him.
You might have dozed.
Only earlier in the evening. I have been awake for the past two watches.
I'll guard the stage and properties for you, I said, if you'd like to sleep now.
The truth was that I was afraid to lie down again.
Dr. Talos seemed to hesitate, then said,
That's very kind of you.
And stiffly lowered himself onto my now dew-soaked blanket. I took his chair, turning it so I could watch the fire. For some time I was alone with my thoughts, which were at first of my dream, then of the claw. The mighty relic chance had dropped into my hands. I felt very glad when Jolenta began to stir and at last rose and stretched her lush limbs against the scarlet shot sky. Is there water? She asked. I want to wash. I told her that I thought Baldanders had carried the water for our supper from the direction of the copse, and she nodded and went off to look for a stream. Her appearance, at least, distracted my thoughts. I found myself glancing from her retreating figure to Dorcas's prone one. Jolenta's beauty was perfect. No other woman I have ever seen could approach it. Thecla's towering stateliness made her seem coarse and mannish in comparison. Dorcas's blonde delicacy as meager and childlike as Valeria, the forgotten girl I had encountered in the atrium of time.
Yet I was not attracted to Jolenta as I had been to Agia. I did not love her as I had loved Thecla, and I did not desire the intimacy of thought and feeling that had sprung up between Dorcas and me, or think it possible. Like every man who ever saw her, I desired her, but I wanted her as one wants a woman in a painting. And even while I admired her, I could not help but notice, as I had on the stage the night before, how clumsily she walked, she who appeared so graceful in repose. Those round thighs chafed one another. That admirable flesh weighed her until she carried her voluptuousness as another woman would have carried a child in her belly. When she returned from the copse with drops of clear water shining in her lashes, and her face as pure and perfect as the curve of the rainbow, I felt still almost as though I were alone.
I said there's fruit if you want it. The doctor had me save some last night, so we'd have something for breakfast.
Her voice was husky and slightly breathless. One listened as if to music.
I'm sorry, I told her. I was thinking.
Yes, I'd like some fruit. That's very kind of you.
I won't get it for you. You'll have to fetch it yourself. It's there, behind that stand of armor.
The armor to which he pointed was actually of cloth, stretched over a wire frame and painted silver. Behind it I found an old basket containing grapes, an apple, and a pomegranate.
I'd like something, too, Jolenta said. Those grapes, I think.
I gave her the grapes, and considering that Dorcas would probably prefer the apple, put it near her hand, and took the pomegranate for myself. Jolenta held up her grapes.
Grown under glass by some exultant gardener. It's too soon for natural ones. I don't think this strolling life's going to be too bad. And I get a third of the money.
I asked if she had not trooped with the doctor and the giant before.
You don't remember me, do you? I didn't think so.
She popped a grape into her mouth, and so far as I could see, swallowed it whole.
No, I haven't. I did have a rehearsal, although with that girl thrust into the story so suddenly we had to change everything.
I must have disturbed things more than she did. She was on stage much less.
Yes, but you were supposed to be there.
Dr. Talos took your roles when we practiced, as well as his own, and told me what you were supposed to say. He depended on my meeting him then. The doctor himself sat up at that, almost with a snap. He looked wide awake.
Of course, of course. We told you where we'd be when we were at breakfast. And if you hadn't appeared last night, we would have presented great scenes from and waited another day.
Jolenta, you won't be getting a third of the receipts now, but a quarter. It's only fair that we share with the other woman. Jolenta shrugged and swallowed another grape. Wake her now, Severian. We should be going. I'll rouse Baldanders, and we can divide the money and pack.
I won't be going with you, I said.
Dr. Talos looked at me quizzically.
I have to return to the city. I have business with the Order of Pelerines.
You can remain with us until we reach the main road, then. It will be your most expeditious route back.
Perhaps because he refrained from questioning me, I felt he knew more than what he had said indicated. Ignoring our talk, Jolenta smothered a yawn.
I'll have to have more sleep before tonight, or my eyes won't look as good as they should.
I said, I will, but when we reach the road I must go. Dr. Talos had already turned away to wake the giant, shaking him and striking his shoulders with his slender cane.
As you wish, he said.
and I could not be sure whether he was addressing Jolenta or me. I stroked Dorcas's forehead and whispered that we would have to move on now.
I wish you hadn't done that. I was having the most wonderful dream. Very detailed. Very real.
So was I. Before I woke, I mean.
You've been awake a long time, then. Is this apple mine?
All the breakfast you'll get, I'm afraid.
All I need. Look at it, how round it is, how red. What is it they say? Red as the apples of... I can't think of it. Would you like a bite?
I've eaten already. I had a pomegranate.
I should have known from the stains on your mouth.
I thought you'd been sucking blood all night. I must have looked shocked when she said this, because she added,
Well,
you did look like a black bat bending over me. Baldanders was sitting up now, rubbing his eyes with his hands like an unhappy child. Dorcas called across the fire.
Terrible to have to rise so early, isn't it, good man? Were you dreaming too?
No dreams.
Baldanders answered.
I never dream.
Dr. Talos looked toward me and shook his head, as if to say, most unhealthy.
I'll give you some of mine, then. Severian says he has plenty of his own.
Though he seemed thoroughly awake, Baldanders stared at her.
Who are you?
I'm...
Dorcas turned toward me, frightened. Dorcas, I said.
Yes, Dorcas. Don't you remember? We met behind the curtain last night. You, your friend, introduced us and said I shouldn't be afraid of you because you would only pretend to hurt people in the show. I said I understood because Severian does terrible things, but is really so kind.
Dorcas looked to me again.
You remember Severian, don't you?
Of course. I don't think you have to be anxious about Baldanders just because he's forgotten. He's big, I know, but his size is like my Fuligen clothes. It makes him look much worse than he is. Baldanders told Dorcas,
You have a wonderful memory. I wish I could recall everything like that.
His voice was like the rolling of heavy stones. While we were talking, Dr. Talos had produced the money box. He jingled it now to interrupt us. Come, friends. I have promised you a fair and equitable distribution of the proceeds of our performance. And when that is complete, it will be time to be moving. Turn around, Baldanders, and spread your hands in your lap. Sir Severian, ladies, will you gather around me as well? I had observed, of course, that when the doctor spoke earlier of dividing the contributions, he had collected the night before, he had specified division into four parts. But I had assumed it was Baldanders, who seemed to be his slave, who would receive nothing. Now, however, after rummaging in the box, Dr. Talos dropped a shining azami into the giant's hands, gave another to me, a third to Dorcas, and a fistful of orichalks to Jolenta. Then he began to distribute orichalk singly. You will notice that everything thus far is good money, he said. I regret to report that there are a fair number of dubious coins here as well. When the undoubted specie is exhausted, you will each come in for a share of them.
Jolenta asked, Have you already taken yours, Doctor? I think the rest of us ought to have been present.
For a moment, Dr. Talos's hands, which had been darting from one of us to another as he counted out the coins, paused.
I take no share from this, he said.
Dorcas glanced toward me as if to confirm her judgment and whispered,
That doesn't seem fair.
I said, It isn't fair. Doctor, you took as large a part in the show last night as any of us and collected the money. And from what I have seen, you provided the stage and scenery as well.
If anything, you should have a double share.
I take nothing.
Dr. Talos said slowly. It was the first time I had seen him abashed.
It is my pleasure to direct what I may now call the company. I wrote the play we perform. And like...
He looked around as if at a loss for a simile.
That armor there. I play my part. These things are my pleasure, and all the reward I require.
Now, friends, you will have observed that we are reduced to single orichalks, and there are not enough to make the circle again. To be specific, only two are left. Whoever wishes may have both, by renouncing claim to the ease and doubtful stuff remaining. Severian? Jolenta? Somewhat to my surprise, Dorcas announced,
I'll take them.
Very good. I will not presume to judge among the rest, but simply hand it out. I warn you who receive it to be careful in passing it. There are penalties for such things, though outside the wall. What's this?
I followed the direction of his eyes and saw a man in shabby gray advancing toward us.
Chapter 35 Hedor. I do not know why it should be humiliating to receive a stranger while sitting on the ground, but it is so. Both the women stood as the gray figure approached, and so did I. Even Baldanders lumbered to his feet, so that by the time the newcomer was within speaking distance, only Dr. Talos, who had reoccupied our one chair, remained seated. Yet a less impressive figure would have been difficult to imagine. He was small of stature, and because his clothes were too large for him, seemed smaller still. His weak chin was covered with stubble. As he approached, he pulled a greasy cap away to show a head on which the hair had retreated at either side to leave a single wavering line like the crest of an old and dirty bergenot. I knew I had seen him elsewhere, but it was a moment before I recognized him.
Lords, he said. O lords and mistresses of creation, silken-capped, silken-haired women, and men commanding empires and the armies of the foemen of our photosphere. Tower strong as stone is strong as the oak that puts forth leaves new after the fire. And my master, dark master, death's victory, viceroy over the night. Long I signed on the silver-sailed ships, the hundred-masted whose masts reached out to touch the stars, I, floating among their shining jibs with the Pleiades burning beyond the top royal spar, but never have I seen aught like you. Hathor am I, come to serve you, to scrape the mud from your cloak, wet the great sword, carry the basket with the eyes of your victims looking up at me, Master, eyes like the dead moons of Verthandi, when the sun has gone out. When the sun has gone out. Where are they then, the bright players? How long will the torches burn? The freezing hands grope toward them, but the torch bowls are colder than any ice, colder than the moons of Verthandi. Colder than the dead eyes. Where is the strength then that beats the lake to foam? Where is the empire? Where the armies of the sun, long-lanced and golden-bannered? Where are the silken-haired women we loved only last night?
You were in our audience, I take it, said Dr. Talos.
I can well sympathize with your desire to see the performance again, but we won't be able to oblige you until evening, and by then we hope to be some distance from here.
Hedhor, whom I had met outside Agilis's prison with the fat man, the hungry-eyed woman, and the others, did not seem to have heard him. He was staring at me, with occasional glances toward Baldanders and Dorcas.
He hurt you, didn't he? Writhing, writhing, I saw you with the blood running red as Pentecost. What honor for you! You serve him too, and your calling is higher than mine.
Dorcas shook her head and turned her face away. The giant only stared.
Dr. Talos said, "Surely you understand that what you saw was a theatrical performance?" I remember thinking that if most of the audience had had a firmer grip on that idea, we would have found ourselves in an embarrassing dilemma when Baldanders jumped from the stage.
I understand more than you think. I, the old captain, the old lieutenant, the old cook in his old kitchen, cooking soup, cooking broth for the dying pets. My master is real, but where are your armies? Real, and where are your empires? Shall false blood run from a true wound? Where is your strength when the blood is gone? Where is the luster of the silken hair? I will catch it in a cup of glass. I, the old captain of the old limping ship, with its crew black against the silver sails and the coal sack behind it.
Perhaps I should say here that at the time I paid little attention to the rush and stumble of Hedhor's words, though my ineradicable memory enables me to recreate them on paper now. He spoke a gobbling sing-song with a fine spray of spittle flying through the gaps in his teeth. In his slow way, Baldanders may have understood him. Dorcas, I feel sure, was too repelled by him to hear much of what he said. She turned aside as one turns from the mutterings and cracking bones when an Alzabo savages a carcass, and Jolenta listened to nothing that did not concern herself. You can see for yourself that the young woman is unharmed. Dr. Talos rose and put away his money box. It's always a pleasure to speak to someone who has appreciated our performance, but I'm afraid we've work to do. We must pack, if you'll excuse us. Now that his conversation had become one with Dr. Talos exclusively, Hedhor put his cap on again, pulling it down until it nearly covered his eyes.
Stowage. There's no one better for it than I, the old supercargo, the old chandler and steward, the old stevedore. Who else shall put the kernels back on the cob, fit the fledgling into the egg again? Who shall fold the solemn winged moth with wings each like stuncils into the broken cocoon left hanging like a sarcophagus? And for the love of the master, I'll do it. For the sake of the master, I'll do it. And follow anywhere he goes.
I nodded, not knowing what to say. Just at the moment, Baldanders, who had apparently caught the references to packing, if he had caught nothing else, scooped a backdrop from the stage and began to wind it on its pole. Hedhor vaulted up with unexpected agility to fold the set for the Inquisitor's chamber and reel in the projector wires. Dr. Talos turned to me as if to say, "He's your responsibility after all, just as Baldanders is mine."
There are a good many of them, I told him. They find pleasure in pain, and want to associate with us just as a normal man
might want to be around Dorcas and Jolenta. The doctor nodded.
I wondered. One can imagine an ideal servant who serves out of pure love for his master, just as one can an ideal rustic who remains a ditcher from a love of nature, or an ideal fricatrice who spreads her legs a dozen times a night from a love of copulation. But one never encounters these fabulous creatures in reality.
In about a watch, we were on the road. Our small theater packed itself quite neatly into a huge barrow formed from parts of the stage, and Baldanders, who wheeled this contraption, also carried a few odds and ends on his back. Dr. Talos, with Dorcas, Jolenta, and me behind him, led the way, and Hedhor followed Baldanders, at a distance of perhaps 100 paces.
"He's like me,"
Dorcas said, glancing back.
"And the doctor is like Agia, only not as bad. Do you remember? She couldn't make me go away, and eventually you made her stop trying." I did remember, and asked why she had followed us with such determination. "You were the only people I knew. I was more afraid of being alone than I was of Agia."
"Then you were afraid of Agia?"
"Yes, very much. I still am. But I don't know where I've been, but I think I've been alone wherever I was. For a long time, I didn't want to do that anymore. You won't understand this, or like it, but
yes.
If you had hated me as much as Agia did, I would have followed you anyway.
I don't think Agia hated you."
Dorcas stared up at me, and I can see that piquant face now as well as if it were reflected in the quiet well of vermilion ink. It was perhaps a trifle pinched and pale, too childlike for great beauty, but the eyes were bits of the azure firmament of some hidden world waiting for man. They could have vied with Jolenta's own.
"She hated me,"
Dorcas said softly.
"She hates me more now. Do you remember how dazed you were after the fight? You never looked back when I led you away." "I did. And I saw her face."
Jolenta had been complaining to Dr. Talos because she had to walk. Baldander's deep, dull voice came from behind us now.
"I will carry you."
She glanced back at him.
"What, on top of all the rest?"
He did not reply.
"When I say I want to ride, I don't mean, as you seem to think, like a fool at a flogging."
In my imagination, I saw the giant sad nod. Jolenta was afraid of looking foolish, and what I am going to write now will sound foolish indeed, though it is true. You, my reader, may enjoy yourself at my expense. It struck me then how fortunate I was, and how fortunate I had been since leaving the Citadel. Dorcas, I knew, was my friend, more than a lover, a true companion, though we had been together only a few days. The giant's heavy tread behind me reminded me of how many men there are who wander Earth utterly alone. I knew then, or thought I did, why Baldanders chose to obey Dr. Talos, bending his mighty strength to whatever task the red-haired man laid on him. A touch at my shoulder took me from my reverie. It was Hedhor, who must have come up silently from his position in the rear.
"Master," he said.
I told him not to call me that, and explained that I was only a journeyman of my guild, and would probably never attain to mastership. He nodded humbly. Through his open lips, I could glimpse the broken incisors.
"Master, where do we go?"
"Out the gate," I said, and told myself I said it because I wanted him to follow Dr. Talos and not me. The truth was that I was thinking of the preternatural beauty of the claw, and how sweet it would be to carry it to Thrax with me, instead of retracing my steps to the center of Nessus. I gestured toward the wall, which now rose in the distance as the walls of a common fortress must rise before a mouse. They were black as thunderheads, and held certain clouds captive at their summit.
"I will carry your sword, master."
The offer seemed honestly made, though I was reminded that the plot Agia and her brother had conceived against me had been born of the desire for Terminus Est. As firmly as I could, I said, "No, not now or ever."
"I feel pity for you, master, seeing you walk with it on your shoulder so. It must be very heavy."
I was explaining, quite truthfully, that it was not as burdensome as it appeared. When we rounded the side of a gentle hill and saw half a league off a straight highway running toward an opening in the wall. It was crowded with carts and wagons and traffic of all kinds, all dwarfed by the wall and the towering gate, until the people looked like mites and the beasts like ants pulling at little crumbs. Dr. Talos turned until he was walking backward and waved at the wall as proudly as if he had built it himself.
"Some of you, I think, have never seen this. Severian, ladies, have you been this near before?"
Even Jolenta shook her head, and I said, "No.
I've spent my life so near the middle of the city that the wall was no more than a dark line on the northern horizon when we looked from the glass-roofed room at the top of our tower. I am astounded, I admit. The ancients built well, did they not? Think! After so many millennia, all the open area through which we have passed today yet remains for the growth of the city. But Baldanders is shaking his head. Don't you see, my dear patient, that all these bosquets and pleasant meadows among which we have journeyed this morning will one day be displaced by buildings and streets?"
Baldander said, "They were not for the growing of Nessus."
"Of course, of course. I'm sure you were there and know all about it."
The doctor winked at the rest of us.
"Baldanders is older than I, and so believes he knows everything. Sometimes."
We were soon within 100 paces or so of the highway, and Jolenta's attention became fixed on its traffic.
"If there's a litter for hire, you must get it for me," she told Dr. Talos. "I won't be able to perform tonight if I have to walk all day."
He shook his head.
"You forget I have no money. Should you see a litter and wish to engage it, you are, of course, free to do so. If you cannot appear tonight, your understudy will take your role."
"My understudy?"
The doctor gestured toward Dorcas.
"I'm certain she is eager to try the starring part, and that she will do famously. Why do you think I permitted her to join us and share in the proceeds?" "Less rewriting will be necessary, then, if we have 2 women.
"She will go back with Severian, you fool. Didn't he say this morning he was going back to look for..."
Jolenta wheeled on me, more beautiful than ever for being angry.
"What did you call them? Palaces?"
I said, "Pelerines."
And at this, a man riding a merikip at the edge of the concourse of people and animals reined his diminutive mount over. "If you're looking for the pelerines," he said, "your way lies with mine. Out the gate, not toward the city. They passed along this road last night."
I quickened my step until I could grasp the cantle of his saddle and asked if he was sure of his information.
"I was disturbed when the other patrons of my inn rushed into the road to receive their blessing," the man on the merikip said. "I looked out the window and saw their procession. Their servants carried deeces illuminated with candles but reversed, and the priestesses themselves had torn their habits.
His face, which was long and worn and humorous, split in a wry grin.
I don't know what was wrong, but believe me, their departure was impressive and unmistakable. That's what the bear said, you know, about the picnickers.
Dr. Talos whispered to Jolenta.
I think the Angel of Agony there, and your understudy, will remain with us a while longer.
As it proved, he was half in error. No doubt you, who have perhaps seen the wall many times, and perhaps passed often through one or another of its gates, will be impatient with me. But before I continue this account of my life, I find I must, for my own peace, spend a few words on it. I have already spoken of its height. There are few sorts of birds, I think, that would fly over it. The eagle and the great mountain Teratornis, and possibly the wild geese and their allies, but few others. This height I had come to expect by the time we reached the base. The wall had been in plain view then for many leagues, and no one who saw it, with the clouds moving across its face as ripples do across a pond, could fail to realize its altitude. It is of black metal, like the walls of the citadel, and for this reason it seemed less terrible to me than it would have otherwise. The buildings I had seen in the city were of stone or brick, and to come now on the material I had known from earliest childhood was no unpleasant thing. Yet, to enter the gate was to enter a mine, and I could not suppress a shudder. I noticed, too, that everyone around me, except for Dr. Talos and Baldanders, seemed to feel as I did. Dorcas clasped my hand more tightly, and Hedhor hung his head. Jolenta seemed to consider that the doctor, with whom she had been quarreling a moment before, might protect her. But when he paid no heed to her touch at his arm, and continued to swagger forward and pound the pavement with his stick, just as he had in the sunlight, she left him, and, to my astonishment, took the stirrup strap of the man on the merikip. The sides of the gate rose high above us, pierced at wide intervals by windows of some material thicker yet clearer than glass. Behind these windows, we could see the moving figures of men and women, and of creatures that were neither men nor women. Cacogens, I think, were there, beings to whom the Avern was but what a marigold or a marguerite is to us. Others seemed beasts with too much of men about them, so that horned heads watched us with eyes too wise, and mouths that appeared to speak showed teeth like nails or hooks. I asked Dr. Talos what these creatures were. Soldiers, he said. The panders of the Autarch. Jolenta, whose fear made her press the side of one full breast against the thigh of the man on the merikip, whispered,
whose perspiration is the gold of his subjects.
Within the wall itself, Doctor?
Like mice. Although it is of immense thickness, it's honeycombed everywhere, so I am given to understand. In its passages and galleries there dwell an innumerable soldiery, ready to defend it just as termites defend their ox-eye earthen nests on the pampas of the north.
This is the fourth time Baldanders and I have passed through for once, as we told you we came south, entering Nessus by this gate, and going out a year afterward through the gate calling sorrowing. Only recently we returned from the south, with what little we had won there, passing in at the other southern gate, that of praise. On all these passages we beheld the interior of the wall as you see it now, and the faces of these slaves of the Autarch looked out at us. I do not doubt that there are among them many who search for some particular miscreant, and that if they were to see the one they seek,
they would sally out and lay hold of him. At this, the man on the Merikip, whose name was Jonas, as I learned later, said, "I beg your pardon, Optimate, but I could not help overhearing what you